Hello. We recorded this episode of Table Talk a little earlier in the year, before the current situation with COVID-19 had arisen. So if you hear conversation about restaurants and dinner parties with no mention of social distancing or isolation, that's why. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by Ryan Riley. Ryan is a food writer and stylist and founder of Life Kitchen, which offers free UK-wide cookery classes for people living with cancer. He's written a book of the same name in which he shares innovative recipes that bring the pleasure of eating back to people living with cancer. Ryan, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan, we'll start where we always start on this podcast. Tell us about your earliest memories of food when you were a child.
They weren't glamorous. It was mostly bird's eye, like waffles, potato waffles, and like five or six dishes that my mother would make, like classics, northern classics.
Proper northern classics,
like mince and dumplings.
Yeah,
like,
Panhaggity.
Well, you called it Panhaggity, so you're wrong with that name, and that's okay.
The Sunderland version, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's the better version, I'm just saying. So it was always about that. It was always those real simple foods, and like still one of my favourite things to eat is a jack of potato, because it's just like simplicity. It's like perfection, really, I think. In food, and I think those sorts of things that when I was a child really have influenced how I seek comfort and stuff now. And I think it got kind of the same for everyone, right?
And were you a fussy eater when you were little, or would you eat everything?
I think I still am a fussy eater, which is funny because obviously I'm a food writer and I cook and eat a lot. I have weird food rules. Like if things are meant to be hot, like I just can't eat them if they cool down. Like, you know, if you go to, not glamorous, but Greg's, and you buy something, and it's not hot, I just can't eat it. And I find it really weird.
Do you have, because some people have very strong opinions on custard hot or cold.
It has to be hot.
It has to be hot, really.
That's not even a conversation.
Okay, fine.
And did you learn to cook when you were younger?
No. I taught myself in the last 4 years. And, you know, Life Kitchen's been going for 2. And I think what I love about the fact that I taught myself is, when we're teaching people in the classes, I'm not like some professionally trained, you know, £28,000 to go to Leith's like sort of person. You know, I didn't have that money. Mm. I didn't have those opportunities. So I just was like, let's cook from Jamie Oliver's cookbook. Let's cook from Nigella. Let's learn that way. So, and that's what really influenced me. And then I still make a lot of mistakes now, but I think that's part of the fun of cooking.
That's how you learn, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what about when you're at school? So we should say you grew up in Sunderland.
Yeah.
And you were at school in Sunderland.
Yep.
Did you have school lunches?
I loved school lunches.
What were your school lunches like?
They were so bad that they were good. Everything in primary school, it was like really standard stuff. Like, you know, that pink cake that you always got. That's amazing. Like,
yes.
Iconically amazing. And then the rest of it was just bad. You know, bad standard school food. My secondary school was really bad. It was basically burgers wrapped in pink and white sort of like packaging. Like, wow. Every day. And then when they got rid of it, I was sad.
Yeah, you think fondly of it now, right?
Yeah.
Ryan, tell us about your mother. She died in 2013 and you set up the Life Kitchen in her memory. Did she like to cook?
Yeah, she cooked 5 dishes really well. Panagoli, yeah. Mince dumplings, you know, shepherd's pie, classics, well, at least northern classics. Mm. And the rest of it was, she was, yeah, not very good. But those 5, like, I can't make them as she made them. Even though I try to do it exactly
You're
right.
You're a first engineer, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, it just doesn't work, and I don't understand.
No.
But yeah, the rest of it was just basic. But I kind of loved that. We never really had, like, family meal times in my house. People just ate when they ate. People were always doing their one thing, and it was pretty much always, like, we were so properly working class family. Like, my dad would be at work, my mum would be at work, and I'd just be on the sofa eating, watching Come Dine With Me.
And how old were you when she developed lung cancer?
I was 18.
And you became her carer?
Yeah, immediately. It was one of the best days of my life and one of the worst days of my life that I found out she had cancer. I was in the countryside with my friends and we didn't have any signal, and I was sitting by this lake and it was beautiful and it was sunshine, and I was like, this is... I actually had the thought that said, this is a really good day. And then I came out of that, got mobile signal, and my mum had cancer.
Oh my gosh.
So it was, I remember it so distinctly, not even just because of what happened with my mum that day. It was a day of two halves. Mm.
And did you end up cooking for her as part of caring for her?
No. She didn't want to eat. And when she did, it was ice pops. I say this a lot, and I've written some ice pop recipes in the book, sort of in memory of her, because she only liked that cold, sugary hit. And I understand, like, it was all that, you know, I love ice pops now, I think, because of her. And it's that cold, sugary deliciousness that she could only taste. So it'd be like little piles of them on the side of the sofa. And if you're ill and that's all you want to eat, let them eat it, you know?
And this was a consequence of the chemotherapy. It's a common consequence of chemotherapy that you lose the ability to taste in the way you have for, or things taste weird.
Yeah, it doesn't happen to everyone, and it's chemotherapy, radiotherapy, cancer treatment in general.
Okay.
It has different effects on everyone, which also makes it really hard to run Life Kitchen.
Yeah.
Because we have to sort of go down the middle. There's no magic bullet. This is going to work for everyone. We're just trying to find the ways that we can just get little bits of happiness and enjoyment into people's lives, which during a really tough time.
So at what stage did the idea of Life Kitchen... In fact, no, let's backtrack, because before Life Kitchen came to you, you entered into the food world. Is that the right order?
Yeah, yeah.
So first of all, tell us how you ended up in London working in food, because that's a weird story in itself.
It is. So 3 weeks after my mother died, one of my friends said, let's go to the casino. And I was like, you know what? Why not? It's been a horrible, miserable time. Let's do something for us. And I was like, I don't really have much money. And I didn't want to ask my dad. My mother, my mum just died. My sisters, you know, they didn't have anything. So I was like, we had maybe 20 quid between us. And we went to the casino and I was like, if we win 50, that's enough for a great night out in Newcastle. Like, really is.
You can have the whole lot.
So I went and I played blackjack. And I'd played a little bit of it before, but I wasn't an expert. And they had this little side bet. And it was £1, and you got four aces of the same colour, the same suit, you won the jackpot. And I got four aces, same colour, same suit, and I won the jackpot, and I won £28,000.
Wow, gosh.
I know, it was wild. I was 20 years old, my mother had just died, and I suddenly won all this money.
I mean, you could have used that in a number of different ways.
And actually, I think I've
had a really good night. And
I think maybe part of me wanted to do that, part of me wanted to go off the rails and just, you know, my mother was dead, I didn't really know what my life was going to be. I was so, so deeply sad. But I decided instead to go back to the council flat I had with my best friend Kimberly, who co-wrote a lot of this book with me. And I went back there and we hadn't really paid our rent, you know, we didn't have much money. And so I just went, pack your stuff. And we flew to Barcelona on holiday and then flew back into London and never left.
Wow.
Oh, and what did you then do in London? What was your first adventure?
We started a fashion blog. And it was just because I really wanted to know what fashion shows were like. And actually, what's really remarkable is how easy it is to get into fashion shows. You email the PRs, they send you an invite. So we were always...
That's a secret.
Yeah, there you go. We literally went to so many shows and we wrote this blog and it was probably really terrible. Then we got asked to be the menswear editors of a cult magazine in London called We Are Collision. That was doing it really well at the time. So we did that. Fashion was sort of not really what we were good at. And then that ended up getting sold to someone else and we were drunk, as all my good ideas have always been, and we were making gyoza in the kitchen from Jamie's book or something, no, from the Dumpling Sisters, I think.
Ah.
And we just started making these and we were like, you know what, we should do this for a living, because when you're drunk you think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm the best person ever to make dumplings.
Yes, and I'd never made them before that time. It was the first time. I'm like, look, I've got this. So we emailed Camden Market and we said, look, we want to do this, you don't have anything like it, and we included a sample menu. Never written it.
Did you just make it up off the top of your head?
Amazing. That's exactly what I did. And I forgot about it. And 2 days later, I got an email back from them. And it said, we'd love you to come join us at Camden Market. We don't have anything like that. So I called my dad and I was like, can I loan £5,000? He was like, absolutely not. And I was like, can I loan £2,000? He was like, I'll come down. I'll get you the basic stuff you need. If you think this is going to work, then I'll let you do it. And it really did not work in the beginning. We decided, and this is, I think I was really ahead of my time, but we decided to make fusion gyoza. So we had fish and chip gyoza.
Wow.
And Sunday roast gyoza. This is genuine. I don't think the world was ready back then. But now, the world's a strange place now.
And maybe it's time to restart.
Yeah. I'm going to launch it, actually.
So how long did you run your gyoza store for?
2 years. And I don't think we ever really made any money. Because you used to get it at the end of the day, and by the time you'd paid everything out, you'd look at it and make 20 quid, so we'll have some dinner, shall we? And start it all again the next day.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I loved being with people. I've always been a people person. And also, I've always sort of been quite an entrepreneur in it. So I would just walk around and do all of the fun stuff, and Kim would just have to be there actually cooking.
Actually
like, oh my God, there's people. And that's kind of how it's always been. So yeah, that was an adventure.
How did you go from there to Life Kitchen?
Well, Curb bought out Camden Market and they said you need to upgrade your stall to like a wooden hut, and I was like, I don't have that money. So we left and Kimberly went to become a head chef in a pub, and I emailed Mitzi Wilson, who was the former editor-in-chief of Delicious and BBC Good Food, and at the time she was food director of Sainsbury's magazine, And I emailed, I don't know how I even found an email. I emailed her and I said, look, this is what I want to do. This is who I am. Will you help? And she was like, yeah, come on in. And she said from the moment she met me, she was like, you're always going to do something cool in food. Mm. And I just want to help you get there. So I did a 3-month internship. And then that was sort of it. 3 months of in the test kitchen, cooking and testing other people's recipes. And if there's one way to learn to cook, is testing other people's recipes and realizing their mistakes. Absolutely. And trust me, chefs are the worst recipe writers. Nearly every recipe was always wrong in some way. So I just sort of had a crash course in it.
And was the idea of doing some kind of cookery school to help people with cancer something you've been harboring for a while, or was it like the gyoza stand? Did it come out of the blue?
It was also when I was drunk, then I came up with that. It sounds
like a lot of good ideas coming out.
I think my dad would disagree, but yeah, it's always been part of, you know, I've always had these ideas, and I think I'd thought of it before. I'd been thinking back a lot on my mother's experiences, and I thought, and it was kind of grandiose of me, I guess. I was like, I could help with this. And then it turns out that I could, in some way.
Yeah.
And did anything like this exist already, or was it a
not
new
that
adventure?
I could find. And the way it happened was, my partner at the time had called to say he was going to be late home because he was taking this homeless guy for dinner. And I was like, what a nice thing to do. Maybe I should put that nice idea that I've been thinking about out in the world. So a vodka and Coke later, because I'm definitely Northern. seriously, that's like, I'm so common. I love it, though. Vodka, Coke, champagne and gin. That's my life in 3 drinks. So I had this drink, and then I tweeted this idea, and I literally said something. I want to go back. It was a Tuesday night. And I've got this thing about Tuesday. I like to launch things on Tuesday nights now. Because, I don't know why, because it went really well. I tweeted something like, and I need to go back and find that tweet, because that's the tweet that started it all. I've got a bloody book now. At a cookery school.
Just from one Tuesday night tweet.
I think some Silicon Valley investors would love the idea of a Tuesday night is when things happen. Some would invest millions in that idea. But I literally said something like, I want to do one cookery class. Can someone help with the venue and maybe the food? And I said, this is why.
Mm.
And it just went wild, like a few hundred retweets later. And I was like, well, now I've got to do it.
It would be embarrassing not to.
Yeah, a few hundred people are counting on it now.
And what did you cook in that first class?
Well, that's all. We're not there yet. There's a long way to go from there. So I thought, well, you know, I can't afford to do this class. So I did a little GoFundMe, and we raised £10,000 quite quickly. And the head of GoFundMe and the head of PR called, and he said, I love this idea. Do you want to go on Video 4 Today programme? I was like, that's the biggest in the country. 10 million listeners, casual. I haven't done anything about this idea yet. So he said, go on it and see what the public thinks. And within my two and a half minute appearance, the GoFundMe went up £4,000 or £5,000. I had hundreds of emails, texts, tweets. Wow. And one of them was from Hugh Fenley-Whittenstall.
Uh-huh.
Hugh Fenley-Whittenstall's team had called and said, look, we heard you on the radio. We'd absolutely love to do this with you. And my mother's favourite show was River Cottage. And I was like, well, this is like, you know, it's meant to happen.
Yeah.
So eventually, you know, I went back and forth with them to find a date. And I was just pacing the streets of London. I was on this like ridiculous high from all.
Yeah,
I was like,
it must have been incredible.
It was. I remember sitting in this restaurant. I was just like on my own at lunchtime. Like I needed to sit somewhere and just figure out what was going on. Because I was getting like, my phone was going wild.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know what I'd gotten myself into. And sort of like what to do. And it hasn't really stopped feeling like that.
So how long ago was this Radio 4 appearance first day? When did that start?
It was sort of just over 2 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was 2 year anniversary of launching it at River Cottage.
Okay.
So it's been a hell of a process. Very quick.
Tell us about that first class, the first time you did it. This was going to be a one-off right at this stage.
I didn't even know at this stage. I guess. But by one-off, I mean, I decided to do two in one day because I love to throw myself at this event. So I had a Daily Mail journalist, a camera crew, and 40 guests for my first class.
And you'd never done a cooking class
before?
No,
I'd never taught. I wasn't even really that much of a good cook.
And who turned up? Who were the guests?
Some people flew from Ireland, some people came from Scotland. Sue Perkins co-hosted it with me, as you do. And that moment just changed everything for us. You know, I went on to do it at Jimmy Oliver's Cookery School after that, and then Dalesford, and we went right across the country. And just all of these people just wanted to help. And then suddenly I was very deeply in it, and now I've written a book. Honestly, I don't know. I haven't really stopped to look at how I got here.
It's kind of overwhelming. Yeah.
I just have a few drinks to forget it all.
and come up with a new idea.
Yeah. Who knows what I'll be launching next year?
And tell us about the book. I mean, what kind of recipes have gone into it? Is it specifically for people who've been going through chemotherapy, or is it kind of all types of conditions?
If they're delicious for them, they're delicious for everyone. And yeah. I think that's a key part of what I want to get across. Because I didn't want to create a book that was, you've got cancer, here's a book. Because it's just, that's not a nice thing to have. You don't want that sitting on your shelf. I wanted it to look like a Nigella book. I wanted it to sit on your shelf and you didn't get it because you were ill. You didn't get it because you weren't, quote unquote, normal.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be something that everyone just felt was just as precious, just as lovely as a cookbook is.
Well, the emphasis that you put in it is about putting the enjoyment back into food rather than saying you're a cancer sufferer.
Yeah, we're not based on nutrition. We're not medicine. I'm not saying I can cure cancer, which if you read half the bloody articles that I've ever written about me, they're always like, oh, look at what he's claiming. And I'm like, have you ever read about what I actually have done?
That must be quite frustrating. Yeah. People sort of painting you as
You know, I've got a lot of amazing supporters, like high profile supporters who have been really brilliant, but they always like, don't look below the line. And I can't help it, right? So I always do it. And I'm like, why did everyone say these horrible things about me?
I'm just trying to do a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, social media must be a kind of double-edged sword in that respect, because clearly it's obviously been very instrumental in your success, but also it must be horrible having people kind of going after you.
My favourite thing that someone ever said about me, like a troll, was all he does is squeeze lemons on things. And I was like, you know what? You're not wrong. But if it helps, it helps.
And you've been working, for the book, you've been working with Professor Barry Smith from UCL. Who is an expert in the census. And so what has his contribution been in terms of the recipe development with you?
Well, you know, his contribution has been since before the first class.
Oh, wow.
So I heard him on the BBC World Service on a podcast called The Food Chain, which I actually love. It's really, it's exposed lots of issues. And I just heard him on that. And I just thought, this guy is the sort of person I need. So I just found his number and called him.
And he said,
yeah. And I said, I've written these recipes, and I took them to him, and he said, they're quite, you know, you kind of along the right lines anyway, and I'll tell you why. And I said, thank God, because I'm about to go teach this to people, and I need to know why. And that was the start of our journey. And Barry, myself and Kimberly have just been working like nonstop since then. I always call him up and I'm like, does this ingredient contain umami? He's like, can't you Google that? I'm like, I just want to know, okay?
Just tell me to finish. Because some of the stuff you talk about almost feels instinctual, even though it's not. So the carbonara that you have that has
mint and peas in it.
And it's, tell us about how the mint works physiologically.
So you have a thing in your head, I guess, called the trigeminal nerve. And it's the one that connects your eyes, your nose, and your mouth. And it's what burns when you have too much horseradish, or mustard, or wasabi, or mint. So even when you have too much toothpaste, and you sort of like, it sort of burns in the bridge of your nose.
Yeah.
That's the trigeminal nerve being overstimulated, because it feels like it's been attacked. So we thought, well, let's use some of these little principles and use it to create sensation. So if you can't necessarily get all of the flavour, you can at least get a bit of sensation, so you're getting something back from the dish. It feels a little bit more rewarding. So the peas in that dish contain umami, and the mint is a trigeminal stimulant. And then obviously you've got the pancetta in there, which is a umami-rich, the eggs and the parmesan. It's actually the super, super umami dish, which I talk about a lot in the book. I feel like I should have just called it umami. But someone already did that, so...
And the kitchen's in Sunderland,
yeah.
But it also travels around the country. And how is that working? I mean, are there lots of people who've kind of discovered you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how it works. It just works. The funny thing is about we got so big so quickly that there's no structure behind Life Kitchen. So we've got a strategist now who like was former mayor of London, which is former Boris, and now she's ours.
Wow.
I was like, well, you couldn't get, well, at least, you know, she knows a little bit about getting some structure. So she's been really pushing us to go back and figure out how, you know, you get a booking system instead of just getting people to email you. Like, it just all happened and spiraled so much that we were now in a really good place there. The classes run at it's called The Lodge, all the time there. And then we try to get them to travel. But again, it's trying to find the places that are good enough. Because one of our key principles is that we don't want to just do it anywhere. Because I know when my mother was ill, she wouldn't go to a cook class in a community centre. I mean, I'm not dragging community centres. But like, you want it to be special.
Yeah.
Some of our guests have died since coming to our kitchen. You know, I want them to have whatever time they have to be the best. Because why wouldn't you? So that's a blessing and a curse. Because it means you can only have a certain level of venue.
Yeah.
And I just won't give up on that. And it's everything we do is free as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Tell us why that's important to you.
Because I'm Northern and we were poor. And if my mum and dad wouldn't have been able to afford it, my dad got fired because he took my mum to too many hospital appointments. So we didn't have a lot of money during that time. And if I'd said to my mum then, let's go to a cooking class, it's going to be 50 quid, she'd be like, you know, go away, I'm not doing it. So I thought, well, the only way to make it truly accessible is make it free, which is a nightmare for me.
So how, there must be funding for it somewhere.
There's bits and pieces, but there's incredible organisations that we work with. So we brought out a collaboration with the World Cancer Research Fund, and they're going to fund quite a lot of our stuff this year. The school in Sunderland is funded by the NHS, which is nice.
That's great.
A tiny bit of funding from them in reality, but for us it makes a lot of difference. And then everything else is just, you know, the book paid for some things, and the little bits that I do on other things and events and appearances, which is weird, appearances, like food festivals and stuff, yeah. Sort of really all helps to make it happen. Because a class costs us about £1,000 every time.
Okay.
And take us through a class. Like, what happens in one?
It usually starts with some booze. I don't know if you've seen a kind of theme here. It usually starts with, I always like to just kick it off with maybe a glass of bubbles, just something to get people in the mood. Because who doesn't want to be drunk cooking, honestly?
Exactly.
And then we always start with a thing called pineapple tacos. I'm going to show you it here. I know it's a podcast, but I feel like you need to see it. It's almost iconic. I think it's the dish that I've... this one.
Ah.
So basically what you do is you slice a pineapple.
So the pineapple is the taco itself?
Yeah, it's the taco shell. Wow. So you slice it into a thin round, you fold that up, and you put prawns, coriander, chili, spring onion, and lime in it. We teach this because a lot of the people come to our class, they haven't had flavour and they haven't had something in a while, and suddenly we're showing you in a few minutes that is flavour. I'm not expecting them to make it every day as a starter. It's more about breaking down those barriers and how you then get into the idea of cooking and flavour within a few minutes.
And there are enzymes
when they thought maybe it might have been never going to come back. And pineapple is really good because it has an enzyme that stimulates saliva production.
So that's why it can feel like it's tingling when you eat it.
But it's why also it feels like mouth-watering and delicious. And we associate psychologically those things with being delicious.
Mm.
So there's a load of reasons that this simple-looking recipe is the first thing we do in every class. I think it's like, you know when good restaurants have a signature dish? I'm going to be doing this till I'm 80.
And it just
I can't eat it myself anymore because I must have tried it 300 or 400 times, if not more.
I mean, it's a pretty full-on thing to lose your mother to cancer, having been her carer at the formative age that you were when it happened. It's a pretty big thing to open a nationwide business with celebrity supporters. How has it intersected with your own grief when it's something that is so close to the loss you suffered?
It hasn't always been fun. It really hasn't. There's been a lot of tough times. There's been times when I just look back at it and I'm like, you know, there's people, like I said before, people die all the time. And that's hard. And also, we have had extraordinary success with Life Kitchen that I'd never set out to achieve. I mean, I'm really happy it's happened, but it's also difficult because I have to talk about my mother every day. And most people who go through grief have time to process it and then they sort of push it to the back.
That's the sensible thing to do.
I bring it every single day to the world, to other people, to everyone in the class, to you guys, to the media. And it just, you start to disassociate yourself from it in a way that then maybe doesn't, I'm not entirely sure if it's healthy or not yet. Ask me again in a year.
Yeah.
When either I've burnt out
No, I'm sure you won't have burnt out. And what about when you're cooking for yourself? Do you have the energy to cook for yourself after doing this all day?
You know what my dad says? It's so ironic that I run Life Kitchen but never, ever eat like real food, because you know we finish late. It's like 2 hours to set up, 3 hours cooking class, 2 hours to pack down, and then half the time we're driving around the country, and I'm getting like Greggs at the Morway. I mean, shout out to Greggs, I love, you know, Northern.
As long as it's hot.
Yeah, as long as it's hot. then I starve.
You said that, you know, your idea of comfort food was sort of framed by what you ate when you were younger with your mother in the Northeast. What is comfort to you nowadays?
That's a very good question. I don't know, it comes in many forms. I've had a lot of stuff going on recently. I split with my boyfriend for 4 years, and that, for me, was my comfort. Mm. He was there through all of that. We're still very good friends, but everything has changed. And apparently, when this book comes out, everything's going to change again.
Yeah. You know, is there a dish in the book that you think your mum would have particularly enjoyed? Is there one that you've kind of created with her in mind?
Well, no one's asked me that question yet. And I'm going to have to look at the index, because we wrote 400 recipes for this book, and we only put in, I think, around 86. I know which one would be good. And the way we got down to that is we did a thing called the Refine the Recipe Tour. So we went around the Maggie's Cancer Centres. They're beautiful, like, architect-designed buildings in the grounds of hospitals. So that it's like our principles, nice, beautiful spaces for people to go. And I did these free supper clubs, Kimberly and I went on, we literally hired a van, went on the road as like a really low budget pop star. That's living my best life. And we went on the road and we went around, I think, 9 or 10 of the Maggie centres, and we did these free supper clubs, and we just laid the recipes on the table and we said, eat that, what do you think? And it was called Refine the Recipe. And trust me, the British public are brutal. So they were like, yeah, this is shit. This is out.
Don't like this.
Or this is good. Or, you know, someone would say, this is the delicious. And someone said, I don't know what you're on about, I hate it. Yeah. And then you'd think, well, how do you then find that mid ground? Because like food and recipes are subjective to the person who, you know, we all like different things. Mm. We all taste things differently.
Even without
what
the
lemon
complexities
tastes to me
of,
tastes different to you. And but that's then, that blows my mind when I think about it.
But then when you've got the added complexities of someone who's undergone some kind of cancer treatment that's affected that mm-hmm. in its own esoteric way, mm-hmm. that must be incredibly difficult to then, as you say, refine.
Yeah. Trust me. It's it's been a process. It's been a difficult process to get 86 recipes into this book. Because ones that I thought were brilliant, people did not. But then there's one in here, and it's the last recipe in the book, and the only one that I wanted to photograph differently, and it's called miso white chocolate with frozen berries. And you'll kind of recognise a version of it from the ivy. And it's so funny, because people are like, did you base on the ivy? I was like, I've never been to the ivy. So I haven't. I've been to the, you know, the cheap spin-off ivy. I was there before here. I tweeted you that picture from
you
there. But at the ivy, they do this frozen berries with white chocolate. I thought, that's a good idea for a dish for our guys, because hot and cold, people tend not to love sweet too much during treatment. That's what we found a lot of. They want more tart or a little bit more, not really bitter because that's not a good flavour, but marmalade, like strong, but not overly sweet. So I thought white chocolate's obviously super sweet. So I decided to mix through like a miso. And honestly, I've created the new salted caramel. I have salted, I mean, I'm pretty sure I didn't create it, but it's delicious.
You can take credit for
it. Thank you. Finally, I got the credit I deserve. Hot miso white chocolate with frozen berries.
So melted white chocolate, frozen berries.
Yeah.
It's the last recipe in the book.
Yeah, and it's the best one. I guarantee it's 4 ingredients. Not every single person we tried it with loved it. And I did not give the recipe to anyone during the testing process. No, they loved it. 4 ingredients. And it's hot and cold. You get that different sensations. It's salty, but it's sweet. But it's just the level of salty enough that it tastes interesting. And people love it. And I just don't know what it is about that. I think as a nation, we love sweet things anyway and desserts. But it's just, I think it's one of the recipes that I didn't think was going to be that much of a hit. 4 ingredients. You know, I spent like hours making like recipe testing like 50 ingredient things, trying to get them down to complex flavors. 4 ingredients and people love it. And I can't even tell you what the science is behind that.
It's just a hit.
Yeah.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining our podcast. And Ryan's book, Life Kitchen, is out on the 5th of March from Bloomsbury.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.